I'm going to talk to you about new maps of the world, new ways of looking at the world. Now, the important thing to know is that this is not going to help you get an A at A level. Please don't go to sleep straight away when you hear that. The reason it's not going to help you get an A at A level is because the A levels keep changing. And what I'm showing you are the kind of things that are going to be in the A levels in 5 or 10 years' time. It's not currently in there. When I was at school, I did A level geography. I had to learn where rubber and tin came from, and I had to learn how you might control people in a colony like Nigeria, because you might be sent there as a colonial officer. This information was fairly useless. That was my geography A level. I was taught that an ice age was coming and the world was getting cooler, because that is what people believed in the 1980s. And geographers went to measure glaciers to see how fast they were coming down. And back then they were a bit confused because the glaciers were not coming down, but they still taught people like me at your age that an ice age was coming. And I was taught that Britain was a superior and wonderful nation that should rule the world in various ways. And that turned out to be wrong. A lot of what you're currently being taught in geography A level will be wrong. It's obvious it will be wrong. It doesn't require a great leap of imagination to know it will be wrong. It is a bit annoying that you have to memorize all these facts and learn some statistics and write down things in exams in a particular way to get the marks that you're required, knowing that, in fact, not all of this will be correct. But I'm afraid that's life and you're going to have to do it. But if you find it annoying, if you think this is a bit silly, why am I being told to interpret a particular map in a particular way? For instance, one that suggests that people are twice as likely to be hungry in the Democratic Republic of the Congo than India, whereas in fact there are far more hungry people in India. I'll show you in a minute why. If you're finding it annoying, don't worry. It means you're good. It is annoying. People make new discoveries. Knowledge will change in the future. Exams will change. How we draw maps will change. And when you turn up at university, which again I suspect, well, let's do a little poll. Who thinks they're going to go to university within 1 year? Who thinks they're going to go to university within 2 years? Who thinks within 3 years? Who thinks 4 years or more? Who's not going? But the vast majority of you are going. If you think about questions to ask, you could ask me about that one. When you go to university, for most of you, apart from the brave minority, the lectures you'll get, particularly from human geographers, will be completely different to anything in the A level. That doesn't mean that they're better, it just means that they're different. And if you came and heard me lecture, you'd see maps like this. This is a population cartogram. It's a cartogram of Europe. Areas are stretched so that each small part of the continent is in proportion to the number of people who live there. So the capital cities are large, London is large, Paris is very large and circular, Madrid is large. Areas with few people disappear. It gives you an idea of thinking how important a place is in terms of numbers of people, proportions of people. I'm very used to this map now. This is how I see normal maps. When somebody produces a normal map, I think it's weird, because I'm interested in people. The little book this comes from is called Geography, and I co-wrote it with an A-level teacher whose name is Carl Lee. Okay, it's coloured according to when they joined the European Community or something like it. So the original Iron and Steel Union are the purples, which are kind of Belgium, France and Germany. Britain comes along a bit later, around about 1973, 1975. Spain later. Turkey is red because it's still trying to join. Eastern Europe is green because it joined recently. Switzerland is yellow because it's got some relationships, but it's not a member. Here's an example of what you can do with these maps. So here, you've got a population base map, and on top of it, we've shaded regions of Europe according to the proportion of the local population who were born in another country. Let's try you again. If you were not born in England, if you were born in Wales, Scotland, Ireland, or anywhere else in the world, can you put your hand up? Okay, so we've got a migration rate of about, I'd say, 10%. Yep. But if you're born in England, put your hand up. Yeah, that's 90%. Right? 10% immigrants, 90% from England. You're not typical of Central London. Central London, 20% of the people who live here, work here, were not born here. That's the area of the highest rate of immigration in the UK. And you can see it because we've made London big. And we've made London big because there are enough people in London. And we haven't just made London big, we've made London exactly the right size it should be to represent the number of people who are there. But other parts of Europe have high proportions of people born in another country. Paris, that circle in France, has high proportions. Switzerland has high proportions. Spain, in Madrid, has high proportions, and down on the coast in Spain has high proportion of immigrants. Name me one of the largest groups of immigrants in Spain. One hand up. Go on, shout really loud. Brilliant. We are the immigrants in Spain. Very soon, you could be lucky. You could get to see lots of very elderly people coming back with really good suntans, saying, I want to use the health service, and please can you get a job to pay for look after me? We'll find out soon whether that happens. Currently, the United Kingdom imports quite large numbers of people, very well educated, highly skilled, highly motivated. We didn't pay for education. They come and work here. We think it's a brilliant idea to stop them coming and have our elderly coming back from Spain. And you're going to see what happens. The point of that map is to show that the UK doesn't have unusually high immigration. There are many parts of Europe with high immigration. And the parts of the UK which have high immigration is London and Northern Ireland, which happened, if you looked at the geography of the Brexit vote, and I'll show you that in a minute, happened to be the parts that didn't vote to leave, that were not worried about immigrants so much. Most of England is coloured that yellow colour, which means that less than 5% of people were born in another country. We'll put it another way. Most of England is twice as boring as you. Right? At least 10% of you are born somewhere else. Most of England is not that exciting. Most of England is like Eastern Europe. People don't bother going there. They don't come from another place because it isn't worth it. And interestingly, it's that part of England that voted to leave, partly because it thought it had been told there were too many immigrants. It's fascinating geography to it all. Here's the same map, but I've zoomed into the south of England so you can get an idea about what it looks like. You can use this map to travel around. You could actually use this map to drive from one place to another. All the roads would be properly connected. All the places with few people have been shrunk. So memorize that, okay? Which is not easy, but that's the south of England for you. And then I'm going to show you something upon that map. And that's the vote to leave or remain. The yellow areas are remain, Scotland, a lot of London, places around Oxford. The blue areas are leave. There were more of them. And the cartogram nearest to me shows the proportion of the votes. So when you see something on a map like this, the amount of colour you see is the same as the amount of the thing that actually happened. These maps tend to be trundled out only at election time, as if elections are the only thing that actually matter when it comes to people. And when we don't have elections, people just go back to normal maps. But the normal maps are okay for physical geography. They're not very useful for human geography. Even the weather map. If you drew the weather on this map, it would mean that you could see the weather round about where you live. You don't need to know what the weather's going to be like somewhere where nobody lives, because you're not there. You do need to know whether one part of London or another is going to be rainy, because it affects millions of people. As yet, I haven't seen anybody produce the weather on a map like this. Old maps. This is the map that would have been on school walls around about 1890. So all the parts coloured pink, it's the Empire. But it's also a very old projection. It's the Mercator projection, or one very like it, where compass directions are made into straight lines. It's a projection that allows you to sail ships and explore parts of the world. The projections of our maps, the actual basic choices of how we're going to stretch them out, change over time as we become interested in different things. This map is absolutely no use to show land area. It makes India tiny and Greenland enormous. Greenland is not bigger than India. It makes Russia look very, very big. So this map was very popular in the Cold War because we wanted people to be scared about Russia. The map was superseded when I was at school by a projection called the Gould projection or the Peters projection that made all land area the same size. Africa became bigger, Greenland became smaller. The Sahara was enormous. Now that projection was great if you're interested in land. But if you're interested in people, you have to switch to another projection. And here's the people projection. I'll show you some different ones in a minute, but this is a basic one. So this is the 7.3 billion people on the planet, with every small area of the planet drawn in proportion to those people. The UK, we're just under 1% of the population, so that's 1% of the area. We're only 0.5% of the world's children. If we wanted to carry on being 1% of the population, we need to bring in a lot of children very quickly, or all your parents should have had twice as many as you. If we don't do either of those things, we're going to shrink relatively. Africa is roughly the same size as India. It's roughly the same size as China. The lines there are a best guess than a year ago of the dates when people left particular areas and arrived in other areas. They're guesses. They keep on changing. People keep on discovering fossils and bones in different places. The end dates are the easiest ones to get right, when people arrived in New Zealand, for instance. What's really hard to get right is what went on in China. So I think we've deliberately left China largely blank in there. So it's an attempt on one map to show the movement of people since they left Africa on top of the current numbers of people who are alive. You could go further than this. You could try and draw a map of all the human beings who've ever lived. There are lots of things you could do. What's in your textbooks is not the end of it. There will be new things. And many things in your textbooks are wrong. For some reason, when we get students turn up at university and we ask them how many people can the Earth support, they tend to say 5 billion. I've got no idea why they say 5 billion, but somebody wrote it in the textbook once. It's not true. We're already supporting 7.3, and we could probably easily support 10 if we behave ourselves. That's the problem with population. It's not how many people you have, it's what they do. How much they consume, how much they pollute, how much they waste. Here again, this new map of the world. It was drawn by a cartographer called Ben Hennig. It uses a method that was invented by a man called Mark Newman, whose granddad, probably coincidentally, helped invent the computer and had a PhD student called Turing. So these things are connected to complicated science. Mark Newman is a physicist, not a geographer. Again, you can see that Africa's roughly the same size as India, the same size as China. You can see the Sahara has disappeared into a black line. That's a black line of all the lines of longitude and latitude just crushed together because there's nobody there. You can see Japan because the lights of Tokyo are shining really brightly. Tokyo being one of the largest cities in the world with 30 million people, so it has a size proportional to 30 million people. And you can see little old England over here with London just about. If you've got really good eyesight, right down in the bottom corner, you can see New Zealand with a tiny dot of light on Auckland, which tells you why people your age in New Zealand try to come to London, because it's much more exciting than New Zealand. And of course, you've already noticed the red line snaking its way round. That line is the journey taken by one ship, which was the largest ship in the world just over a year ago. The ship contained so many containers of goods that when they were unloaded at Rotterdam, if the lorries had gone end to end, it would be 100 kilometres long. Just one ship, one 30-day journey from China to Europe. Most of what that ship was taking were things that were going to end up in landfill sites within 2 or 3 years. Clothes that people would wear but not wear out. Toys, games, things you don't actually need, and things not designed to last for a long time. That's our big problem. If people start producing things that will last for a long time and recycle them and stop buying things that they don't really need as much, such as clothes all the time because it's exciting to have new clothes, then we have absolutely no problem for having a future for the planet. But if people carry on consuming more, driving more, flying more, buying more, we're in trouble. If you want to get away from it all, this is a map of where to go. I've just inverted it. So instead of population, this map is showing area in proportion to how far away a place is from the nearest settlement of 50,000 people. It's a map of wilderness. And the big wilderness in the world is Greenland, but the Tibetan Plateau is also pretty big. Siberia is pretty big. But we can also draw these maps locally. So if you want to get away from it all locally, that tells you where to go. These are the parts of the British Isles drawn in proportion to how far they are away from the nearest settlement of 50,000 people. You can draw weird map after weird map after weird map with this kind of software. My favourite ones that have been drawn are ones where every part of the world is drawn in proportion to the amount of water that falls in a month on it. So Brazil is very big. But in the months that the monsoon moves across India, India becomes very big. I'm too untechnical to put it up for you, but the animation of the planet moving looks like a human heartbeat. And it's just the water moving across the land surface of the globe, making the land surface proportional to that water. I may have lost a lot of you, I may have lost all of you. I'm just trying to say that when you're sitting in your classrooms in the next few weeks thinking, why am I have to learn this about the traffic system in Rio de Janeiro or whatever's in the syllabus this year, don't think that that's what the future for geography will be or what you'll be doing at university or later necessarily. We are discovering new things all the time, and all the time we're finding new ways of drawing and describing them. Same idea again. Population cartogram of the world. Every area is drawn in proportion to people. The only thing we've done differently here is we've just taken the oceans out. Because the oceans take up a lot of space and they're interesting, but if you're interested in people, they're not terribly important. And again, it looks different. And it concentrates your mind on different things. If you look at where the cells bulge out, what you're seeing are cities. And if you're ever worried about where the largest cities are in the world, it's a perennial problem because it depends on how you draw the boundary around the city. Well, the largest city in the world is actually in the west of China on that map. It's Chongqing. It's a collection of cities and also paddy fields in the middle of them. But it's the largest bulge on the map. And the center of the world is in India. And we're on the edge, drawn that way. Traditional maps which have us drawn bang in the middle at eye level are not true scientific maps because the UK is in the middle of the picture. Those maps have been designed to make the United Kingdom look as if it's in the middle of the picture. We got to choose the lines of latitude first, so we got to put where the zero is. But when you ever look at an image, it's like looking at a face. The focal point is just above the middle, and it's here. That's where you look first. So with maps of the world with England in the middle of it, it psychologically makes you think you're living in the centre of the world. Which this country was 100 years ago, or whenever this kind of thing was built. Because all the money came here, because we were the centre of the biggest empire since the Roman Empire. Much bigger than the Roman Empire. But we're not there anymore. We're now a smaller country, getting smaller on the edge. And so you have to draw your maps a bit differently if you want to show what's happening. Food. This is one map of where food is grown in the world. It's not the correct or true map. Russia's far too large in this map because although quite a lot of food is grown there, it's not of the same quality of food as grown elsewhere. But that's where we're going to get fed. That's where our food comes from. People often say that we should plant and grow much more food much nearer to where we are. It would be nice, but it's not possible to do enough of that so that everybody could eat locally. Although the fastest way you can improve it is by stopping eating meat, which makes things a lot easier. But that's where the population of the planet is fed. Now, you'll have seen this map before. This is the Earth at Night map. And when you saw this map before, what you were told you were seeing was a map which showed you where people were. But of course, it wasn't a map that showed you where people were. It's just a map of lights. And when we put the map up on this projection, you're now seeing a base map that shows you where people are. There are people living at equal density on every point on that map. So the map, exactly the same map, exactly the same data that you've seen drawn, is not telling you where the population is. It's telling you something very different. It's telling you where people live who have so much spare money that they can afford to shine lights up in the sky so that a satellite can take a picture of them. It's a map of light pollution. The same data on a different projection shows you something very different with potentially a very different political message. There are always political messages. Don't trust anybody who tells you they're neutral. They're either lying or they're not that clever. Every image you see, every point that is made, every lecture that is given has an implicit political message about how things work or should work. So when I was taught A-level geography, and I was taught I needed to know where rubber and tin came from and how people could be controlled and so on, the implicit message was that I should be one of the people who goes out and rules the world. It wasn't said as obviously as that, but it was there. People are always trying to get their points of view over to you. The implicit message of doing this differently is to say, you can't have a planet in which the whole lot is lit up. You can't have people wasting that much electricity just shining it up all in the sky. It really would be silly. You do need electricity everywhere, but you don't need people wasting it. Very, very different message to the message that the other map gives you. Just a normal map of precipitation. Who else can't say that? But on the cartogram. Right, so this isn't the complicated one where I've made the map large where there's more water and smaller where there's less water. This is just a population cartogram with the amount of rainfall drawn on it. Why am I doing that? Because I don't care very much. Dave will, don't worry, because he looks at places that are very dry and generally not very populated. I don't care very much about when it rains on areas where people don't live, because they're not there. I care about rain when it rains on people, because those are the people who either can get too much rain and so they suffer from floods, and that's the dark areas, or they get too little rain and they find it hard to grow crops and hard to find water and hard to keep industry going that needs water. The area with the least rainfall is Egypt, Israel, and the Middle East. The area with the biggest population with least rainfall is Egypt, Israel, the Middle East. It didn't used to be the part of the world with least rainfall. It was once the Fertile Crescent near there. But now it's pretty arid. It's not a very sensible place to base lots and lots of people. That's what you can interpret from that map. It's one thing you can interpret. But luckily, there are not many other parts of the world with so many people that are quite like that. My final slide. Then they're going to force you to ask me something about this. I've shown you seven maps of the world. And I've tried to show you that you can have very different interpretations of these maps. I've tried to show you that somebody who teaches particularly human geography at university, but you'll see it in physical geography with the emphasis on climate change there is now, but somebody who does human geography has a message that they are trying to tell you. The only thing that is interesting is something that you might not agree with the other person. If something that you think and I think is not the same, then we can have a discussion about it. Everything else is not that exciting. This little book, if you're interested, you just Google it, and you can get it for free. And this little book, which just has two graphs in it. This is one of the two graphs. The other graph is about your chance of ever being able to buy a house, which the way things are going, about 10% of you might. Maybe 15, depending on where you're from. I won't try and guess that from what you're wearing, but I could. This graph is about the country you live in. It's about the power of geography to explain political ideas and thoughts. What this graph is showing is the proportion of GDP, that's all our income every year, everything we produce, that is taxed and spent on public services. Now, just showing you this graph is a political act. Most people in Britain do not get to see this graph. The data comes from the International Monetary Fund. And the UK at the end, about 36% of GDP is spent on public services. The big spike in the middle, by the way, are all the governments in these countries bailing their banks out to avert disaster. The biggest spike is Ireland, where things went unbelievably badly wrong when they followed our advice. And we told them, bail out every last bank account in Ireland. And they spent an unbelievable amount of money doing that. But a key point of the graph is just look at the figures at the end, which are the projections that IMF makes on current spending plans, and compare the difference. The country at the very bottom is Ireland, 32%. It's run out of money. Only 32% of its GDP are we paid on public services. The next one is the United States, 35%. And then there's us, 36%. These are three strange countries. You are living in a strange country. It may not appear to be strange to you, because for you this is normal. In fact, particularly normal. Only 10% of you have come from somewhere else and can tell the rest of you about that somebody else. And most of you that come from somewhere else were probably quite young when you did it and can't remember very much. But believe me, you're living in a strange country at a strange time. A country that decides to only spend 36% of its GDP on public services. A choice was offered at the last general election, the one that hardly any of you can vote in because you're under 18. The choice was between an increase, that was the Labour manifesto, all roughly staying the same. The increase was to about 37%. That's what Labour were offering. Do things like get rid of tuition fees for universities, fund the NHS a bit more, and taking that little 36 UK at the end up to 37 UK. That was the massive, irresponsible Labour promise. Terrible. Awful people, that Labour Party. Don't have any idea about economics, do they? How could you possibly spend 37% of public money on GDP on public spending? Now look at the basket cases above. Finland. It's a wasteland. People are starving in the streets in Finland. They tax and spend 57% in Finland. Their schools are awful. On the international league tables, their schools are at the top. Oh dear. But the people aren't happy. They haven't got jobs. They don't invent anything. If we go down, Denmark, not happy in Denmark. France, Sweden, Italy, even Greece, Germany. Germany spends £1 billion more than we do on health every week. Forget 350 million. Germany spends £1 billion. What I'm doing here, apart from being overtly slightly political, is trying to show you the fun in human geography, some very simple bits of human geography, just comparing countries. Now, none of this is in your A-level syllabus. It can't be in your A-level syllabus because the Minister of State for Education gets to decide what's in your A-level syllabus. And believe me, the Minister of State for Education wouldn't like this to be in the A-level syllabus, so you're not going to be taught it. But you can Google and get the book for free if you actually want to know how the countries compare and are different. And in other countries, the government Minister for State for Education doesn't get to decide what you're taught, because you're living in a very strange country at a very strange time. My time's almost up. I've got about 2 minutes. I've been trying to goad you to have a question. Is anybody going to be brave? Question about anything at all? I've got bad eyesight, so please wave. We've got a mic even. So you'll be heard. Is there one at the back? So somebody just tidying their hair. Here we got one. Wait for the mic. Everybody will hear you when the mic comes. It's a bit like question time when that David Dimbleby is really nasty and doesn't let people speak.
Do you still think that a university degree is viable today?
Great question. I think it is valuable if you're absolutely sure you want to go and you're sure what you want to study. If you're not sure, and I know some teachers will get annoyed at me for this, wait a year. Take a year out. Go travelling. You can be a willing worker on organic farms. You know, you've got to dig potatoes, but they'll feed you and put you up for a year around the world. You can travel for nothing around the world. And for geography, travelling is great. Do not go to university straight away if you're not sure that the course and the place is what you really want to do. And the reason for that, and it should always have been good advice, but in the past, when I went, if I'd made a mistake, I'd have just lost 2 or 3 years of my life. But it wouldn't have cost me anything. If you go to university, and after a couple of years, decide that it's not working out for you and drop out, a friend of mine, their son, has done that. He's working in Tesco's and he's got a £28,000 debt. He doesn't have to pay that debt back while he's working in Tesco's because he's not paid enough. But if he ever gets a job that pays him enough, he's got to pay £28,000 back for the 2 years he spent in Cardiff, which turns out to be a mistake. A degree can be very, very valuable. The pressure to go is enormous because your parents and teachers went at a time when it was just idiotic not to go. It is now much more important to be careful and sure because otherwise the repercussions are worse than they were before. That's my honest answer. That's why when my son says he doesn't want to go 18, I am exceedingly happy. But that is unusual. One more question. Or maybe two. We do two, one here and then one there. Don't know where Dave is. He'll get annoyed at me.
What topic would you most like to see added to the A-level syllabus?
Oh, what topic were they? Well, they're different. There's a few different syllabuses. I would do inequality in Britain and just do it head on. It means you can do field trips which are local. You know, rather than flying halfway around the world to some exciting field trip, often you can simply... I used to live in Sheffield. Sheffield High School for Girls was the most expensive school, and they used to fly to the Himalayas for their geography field trip, which I'm sure is very exciting. If Sheffield High School for Girls had just walked 4 miles eastwards, they would have learned a lot more than flying to the Himalayas in their own cities. That's what I would add, and it's cheap. Last question, which is at the very back.
Hiya.
Hiya, go on. You have to get your friend to ask it. It's too embarrassing to ask.
Do you want to do for a final option somewhere else?
Final option, okay, go on. Young man at the end, final option somewhere else. That's why people don't ask questions. They fear that's going to happen.
Hello? Oh, okay. Yeah. So would it be possible on your population cartography maps, yeah. Would it be possible to demonstrate population density by using, like, heat sort of, you know, colours, like darker colours, but also, but still managing to represent distance on, like, a regular map does, so while also managing to demonstrate population density, or would that not work?
You're going to bring out my inner nerd. So on a population cartogram, you can colour each area by the density at which people live, and it becomes obvious that a lot of people live at high density, whereas on a normal map, the high density areas are very small, because most land is not covered at people at high density, but most people live at high density in cities. What you can do then, and nobody's done it, somebody proved in 1974 it was possible, nobody's done it. You can then begin to stretch that map into the third dimension. It's still a surface, like a rubber surface. And you can begin to make the distances, rather than being proportional to the square root of people, which is what they are on a cartogram, you can make them proportional to real distance, or better still, travel time. So that your distances are actually telling how long it takes to get from one area to another. And if you do that, London becomes the biggest mountain in the United Kingdom because it has the longest travel time. But going into London are tunnels, and that's the train routes that go into London. And on top of London, there are tightropes, and that is the air flows of people into London who are on all the aircraft moving in. And I can see all of this in my mind, but I don't feel guilty that I'm not showing it you, because nobody has yet invented this way of mapping. We just know it is possible to do it. I hope I've made you see some different things in geography. Good luck with your A-levels.